Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 8th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Heather Parton, columnist at Salon, proprietor of the blog Hullabaloo. You may know her as Digby. Also on the program today, Ms. Judy Gold, comedian, author, philosopher, sometimes yeller. She'll be joining us today. Meanwhile, the Senate passes a two-month debt limit extension. And Chuck Schumer, so victorious. Never seen anybody celebrate a punt in quite that way. And despite punishing the unemployed by removing unemployment benefits, jobs growth is still anemic. Pfizer is seeking FDA authorization for the use of its vaccination for 5 to 11-year-olds. And some Texas abortion clinics resume abortion services after a federal judge halts the Texas abortion ban. Trump aides defy January 6th commission subpoenas. Remains to be seen. Democrats will insist that subpoenas mean something. Biden administration reinstates the federal climate adaptation and resilience reports. Spoiler alert, bleak. 44% of Republicans, speaking of bleak, want Trump in 2024. I can assure you it'll take about 15 minutes for that number to get up closer to 75-80% of Republicans once that campaign starts. Meanwhile, Biden also uses executive authority to restore environmental protection to three national monuments and at least 100 people dead or injured in Afghanistan as a mosque is bombed. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday. The week has just flown by. And particularly for Emma, because she is off today. So she's gone. Doing the solo, of course. Matt and Bradley are here. And all of you are here, and I appreciate your coming today. We got a couple of things to discuss, obviously. This is... I guess we should just play this Chuck Schumer thing. Like, you know, the controversy and frankly the existence of the debt ceiling has now reached such farcical levels that it is stunning. And what is really I guess upsetting about this is that the Democratic Party, the Democratic leadership, seems to think this is some type of winning political issue for them. I can't tell if it's just a desperate desire not to talk about the reconciliation bill or what, but this is just, it is absurd. It is absurd. And there were four major things that the Democrats had to do in the month of September. Pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill, pass the reconciliation, the budget bill, pass a continuing resolution for the budget so that there isn't a government shutdown, and pass a hike on the debt ceiling, or eliminate the debt ceiling for that matter. They punted three of those. I mean, in other words, nothing got done. Everything was just put off in some way. And I am completely aware of, and I think everyone is, for the most part, who follows politics, of the obstructions here and the obstacles. The Republicans, Joe Manchin, Kristen Sinema, Josh Gottheimer. None of this was not predictable or predicted. I mean, we're sitting here in a closet in Brooklyn and we could see this coming from a mile away. Mile away, we could see it coming from 25 miles away, 30 miles away. And it doesn't seem like there was any plan for any of this. Apparently, Chuck Schumer knew that the Joe Manchin's number was $1.5 trillion in June or July.
Does he have, like, avoidance anxiety or something? Just didn't want to deal with it?
Well, and here is, like, and this is the thing that, you know, I don't care if Chuck Schumer goes up there and throws a garbage at any of those Republicans. I mean, literally. But there seems to be a disconnect as to, you know, the sort of the value of certain political victories and the value of certain political victories that permeates the Democratic leadership. Here is Chuck Schumer slamming Republicans for playing with the debt ceiling because they're being hypocritical. Clip number two.
Now, Mr. President, in a few moments, the Senate will pass an extension of the debt limit through early December, avoiding a first ever Republican manufactured default on the national debt. On Monday morning, I said we needed to pass a bill to address the debt limit by the end of the week, and that is exactly what we did. Republicans played a dangerous and risky partisan game. And I am glad that their brinksmanship did not work. For the good of America's families, for the good of our economy, Republicans must recognize in the future that they should approach fixing the debt limit in a bipartisan way. What is needed now is a long-term solution so we don't go through this risky drama every few months. And we hope Republicans will join in enacting a long-term solution to the debt limit in December. We're ready to work with them. Leader McConnell and Senate Republicans insisted they wanted a solution to the debt ceiling, but said Democrats must raise it alone by going through a drawn-out, convoluted, and risky reconciliation process. That was simply unacceptable to my caucus. And yesterday, Senate Republicans...
You can see Joe Manchin putting his hands in his head. I don't know why he does that other than, like, I can't wish enough exhaustion on Joe Manchin. But Chuck Schumer's up there, you know, sort of doing a victory lap. I said we'd get this done and we got it done. Well, you didn't get it done. You just put it off by 2 months. Then you're out there still pushing this notion of, like, I mean, has since the moment that Joe Biden announced that they were going to get bipartisan with all of this stuff, his numbers have fallen precipitously with independents in a way that, like, it's almost hard to understand how they could have fallen more. Like, there, it seems that whatever he did was the exact opposite of what should be done. Now, part of that undoubtedly was a function of missing the vaccine mark and I think probably more so just the resurgence of Delta, which I obviously couldn't do anything about. But the reaction to all of this, the slowing down of the agenda after the COVID bill, this laser-like focus on the bipartisan nature of the process that the Republicans are not playing along with. Every single time Chuck Schumer complains about the Republicans refusing to play nice and be bipartisan in passing this, he is announcing to the American public that he is incompetent. He is announcing to the American public that if you put Democrats in charge, we're going to have these type of problems.
It's like you want your football team to win a game, and then they announce, like, we got a victory to announce. We got a deal to keep the lights on this Sunday.
It's every time he talks about, complains about the Republicans bullying him, which is what he's doing. He is announcing to the American public, who don't pay attention to any of the details, just that, like, we can only do so much to protect you. On one hand, I'm announcing to you that the Republicans are a fundamental threat. A fundamental threat to your ability to go to work tomorrow and cash your checks. And on the other hand, I'm just telling you, like, we're barely holding on here. Well, wait a second. I think I'll choose the option where we're not barely holding on. They have to start coming up with a different take here that doesn't involve, we barely got by, how big and bullying these people are. You're not going to, I mean, never mind all the policy implications, but as a political matter, you're not going to convince anybody by telling them that we're just hanging on by the skin of our teeth because these Republicans are almost too much for us to handle. That's just not going to cut it. And somehow, you know, Chuck Schumer's up there thinking, like, nailed it. Nailed it. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back with Heather Parton after this. Folks, a couple of sponsors of today's program. I really feel like I need some of this right now. SunsetLakeCBD.com, ladies and gentlemen. One of our movement sponsors, they have great politics. They have great business practices, $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. Perhaps from the perspective of their CBD, they have great agricultural practices, integrated pest management, no pesticides, organic fertilizer, regenerative agriculture practices in conjunction with the University of Vermont. You can go on their website, get a breakdown analysis of exactly what is in every single one of their products. The tinctures comes in multiple concentrations of CBD, 3,000 meg, 750 meg. They have some with melatonin in it. They have gummies that are delicious. They have fudge. They have coffee that is roasted with CBD. They have arnica and CBD salve, great for your muscles. They have hand lotions, all sorts of great products. We get a tremendous amount of positive feedback. They have smokables. Matt's sitting there sniffing his keef.
Got a whole ounce of keef here. An ounce of keef. People know what that means. And that's it's nice. Nice to cut in with your other smokables.
We get really great feedback for our partnering with SunsetLakeCBD.com. So check it out. Left is best. Left is best. Gets you 20% off. Use the coupon code LEFTISBEST. One word, LEFTISBEST. 20% off. Check it out right now. Appreciate their sponsorship. Really do. Also, I don't know if I want to. I'll do that. This one's sort of like a movement sponsor. Emma's glad she missed this. It's Tushy, the modern bidet that attaches directly to your toilet in under 10 minutes. And it's true, actually. That is a... there are two things that I hear back from people about Tushy. One is they are... Well, three things, I guess. One is they're amazed at how inexpensive it is, particularly relative to a full-on bidet. Two, how easy it is to install. And three, they love it. They absolutely love it. I went bidet, never looked back, add to the pun, after that. And you don't have to, for the most part, because it washes your butt with a clean stream of water. You poop, you wash, you pat dry. Tushy bidet washes your bum with water for better clean than toilet paper. I think that's pretty obvious. Washing with water, less irritating. Also, more effective. Tushy bidet is easy to install and attaches to your toilet, like I say, in under 10 minutes. There is no electricity or plumbing needed. Using a Tushy bidet reduces your toilet paper use by 80%, and that, of course, as you know, saves you money. And frankly, a headache. It is eco-friendly, and it is stylish. Start washing with a Tushy bidet for a better clean. Go to hellotushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping. Special offer for our listeners at hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. After you buy and install your Tushy, show it off. Tag at HelloTushy on Instagram. All right. I want to welcome back to the program with a frequent guest on this program over the years, over a decade, so much so that we even have something like this.
Are you ready for some pee-pee? Yeah. Are you ready for some pee-pee?
There you go. Her own song-based introduction. Heather Parton Digby, welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, Heather. All right, let's... there's a couple of things I want to talk to you about. Obviously, we got to talk about the debt ceiling and Kristen Sinema. She had some very, very difficult times this week. Very difficult times. But I also want to touch on this Senate report, which I think has gotten not that much attention in terms of the January 6th thing. We also have what's going on down in Texas. But let's just start with the debt ceiling. We just played a clip of Chuck Schumer really handing it to the Republicans rhetorically. And, you know, apparently this upset the Republicans, but who cares? Their behavior is sort of fixed behavior anyways. And it's just something for them to cry about. But what bothers me more about it is it's sort of an indication that Chuck Schumer thinks that this has any value whatsoever. Everything that's happened, like a fundamental misunderstanding that this is just all, it's just all bleeding, essentially, of Democratic support.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, and part of the issue here is that, you know, the Republicans are running one of their standard hissy fits, right? I mean, this is the same thing that happened with Kyrsten Sinema earlier in the week. They're all just sitting there going, oh, you know, bring me my smelling salts. You know, I can't, this is terrible, this behavior. It's just so uncivil. And, you know, needless to say, coming from the party of Donald Trump, that's just a little bit rich. And you're absolutely right. The Democrats should not care about this. And it should not be an issue. They shouldn't care. Chuck Schumer can say what he wants. I assume he, you know, as a human being, was frustrated by what had gone down during the week. And he said what he said. And Joe Manchin sat in the background with his head in his hands going, oh, this is so terrible and whatever. But, you know, fundamentally, the fact that Schumer felt the need to say this as, you know, whether or not it was a human reaction or not, says exactly what you're referring to, which is that he is, you know, I don't know that they're getting it. You know, this isn't a matter of, you know, calling out Republican hypocrisy is a meaningless exercise. Shamelessness is their superpower. It doesn't mean anything. Actions speak louder than words, and you just do it. You plow through it. You get it done, and that's it. And you cannot even think about it. And the media too, by the way, who also joined in the pearl clutching over Schumer's rhetoric. You remember they did this with Nancy Pelosi too, but she said what it was, and Paul Ryan came out. Well, we were going to vote for it till her speech, and then we just were so hurt that we couldn't do it. You know, so I mean, this is the nonsense. It just goes on and on and on. And you know, Schumer, and to me, I think exactly as you do. It reflects the idea that somehow or another, this is about making the Republicans feel shame for what they're doing, making them feel bad about it, somehow convincing them that they're doing the wrong thing. Completely irrelevant to our politics right now. Absolutely 100% irrelevant. And they need to just, you know, they need to, well, I say they need, you know, they should, I wish, whatever, that they would dispense with this idea once and for all and recognize that this is hand-to-hand combat at this point, and they have to do what they have to do. And, you know, talking about it doesn't mean a thing.
No, in fact, like I say, I think it actually just projects a tremendous amount of weakness. I mean, you know, and I think by the time it reaches the ears of the people who are ultimately going to vote, I mean, aside from, like, I think we both agree, it's all meaningless. Everything that, including the debt ceiling and the back and forth, is all meaningless except for, because there's no legislative impact to any of this whatsoever. I mean, I think, like, you know, in my most cynical moments, I'm just thinking, like, there are some people out there who just, like, you know, day traders or big institutional, investors who are like, yeah, I mean, I'll buy on the dip. It's like the debt ceiling's not going to happen, but we all know it's going to get raised. And then I'll take that 500-point, you know, bump that came yesterday. I mean, it almost feels like it's just sort of, it's like a game for that on some level. But in terms of what it's going to mean a year from now, my guess is no one's going to remember this from an electoral standpoint, but it feeds into a theme that Mitch McConnell can push around the Democrats, and that Chuck Schumer is we have no agency. There's nothing we can do here. And we know they know there's stuff they can do. Joe Biden this week admitted that it's a real possibility for them to get rid of the filibuster to do this. And doesn't that signal to everybody who has been listening to the Democratic establishment, to the leadership, say, we cannot get rid of the filibuster? It is sacrosanct. How is it that they can contemplate doing it for the debt ceiling, but they can't contemplate doing it for somewhere else? Like, I get that it's because certain people don't want the filibuster to go away, but how about we admit that? As opposed to this sort of idea of, like, it's an institution in the Senate. I mean, and I'm talking about Joe Biden in particular, because he's the one who's been saying that kind of rhetoric. It's an institution in the Senate, except for when it's not.
Well, that's right. And of course, Joe Biden is the one who would have the most clout in this situation if he would just say it and say, yeah, I back getting rid of the fill. It's clear that we can't, you know, that the Republicans are not going to cooperate with anything. We can't even, you know, we can barely keep the government running. They're refusing to help with the debt ceiling. Everything is on the line here. We have to get rid of the filibuster. This is, you know, and you hear people like Amy Klobuchar saying, yes, let's get rid of the filibuster. This isn't a hard lift.
Right.
If Joe Biden would be a leader on this. I think that, and I don't know about Manchin and Sinema. They are working off of a different set of incentives that are going to have to be dealt with in their own right. But just as a general thing, if the Democratic Party and its leader, who is Joe Biden, were to say outright, we want to get rid of the filibuster. We believe this is the only way to help the country, you know, advance or grow or, you know, save itself. That's what we're going to do. Now, Manchin came out last night, I think, and said something so fatuous I couldn't believe it. He said, you know, it's the only, the filibuster is the only thing saving democracy. It's like, you know, I want what he's smoking. Let's just put it that way. I mean, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And it is a problem. I mean, I feel for the Democrats. You've got these two divas marching around doing their thing. And it's a very slim margin, you know, and either of them could decide they're going to switch parties or become independents or do anything. I mean, it's tenuous, but they have 48 senators. You know, this is the big club, right? This is one of the things that gets me. The big Senate club where they all just, it's all about, you know, the saucer that cools the tea and all this. And they sit, they go to the cloakroom and they chatter with each other and they're all buddies and everything. You're going to tell me that 48 senators can't lean on Manchin and Sinema? They have no capability of pushing this to the point where, you know, or finding some way to change the incentives, give Manchin and Sinema something they want. I don't know what they want, but maybe there's something they would take. I don't know, but it doesn't seem like they're trying very hard. And this is, I mean, well, it's that it'll be the destruction of the Biden agenda at the end of the day.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
They don't pass. The Democratic agenda. That's it.
And what I find incredibly frustrating is you're Chuck Schumer. You know for a fact that Joe Manchin has said $1.5 trillion, right? You've been in the Senate with Joe Manchin. Well, I don't know. I guess Joe Manchin's what? He's only on his second term, right? So maybe it's only about 12 years or something. You've been in the Senate all these years. You're the leader of the Senate. Do you think he doesn't mean it? Or do you think, did Chuck Schumer stop to think for a moment? Like, maybe what we need to do is start to reorient the talking here. That maybe we need to talk about it like $3.5 trillion. Maybe we need to start front loading some of these things. Maybe I need to talk to some, you know, maybe I need to talk to Bernie Sanders and say we need to start to try and figure out to front load these things so that we can just in a moment look like we're cutting things in half and doing like there doesn't seem to have been there seemed to have been a very healthy amount of information that Chuck Schumer had, at least regarding Manchin. Maybe he had no clue who Kristen Sinema was, but it was sort of clear when she brought in, you know, Portman and tried to do this bipartisan stuff. It seems like none of them like internalized any of the information that they had. And now we're in this situation here where there just seems to be like, where are these deadlines coming from? Like, because now it sounds like they're not going to be able to reach October 31st with the reconciliation bill. Like, is anybody?
Well, are they listening? Because Joe Manchin wants a strategic pause until next year. Is that what we're talking about? I mean, it's all this kabuki until 2022, or in which case it'll be too late. I mean, this is, you know, I don't know, but he's been saying this stuff and it seems to me, and you know, this is just from afar, you know, observing it. But it seems to me that they have opted for the first choice that you say, which is, wait, he doesn't really mean it. They're assuming that Manchin is just posturing, and for all I know, that may be true. I don't know, but it's clear that so far, whatever posture he's taken has ruled the day. I mean, he and Sinema have managed to get us to this point where the reconciliation, which should have passed already. I mean, come on. It's a Democratic, you know, it's 50 votes. You know, it's like, in fact, in the reconciliation, you can sort of see the hole in the filibuster argument in some ways, because even if we had the filibuster, you'd still have Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Even if we got rid of the filibuster, you'd still have Manchin and Sinema to deal with. So they haven't figured that out. They have not yet figured out what they're doing with that and how they're going to do it. Now, I did have, and there's an article by Bob Greenstein for Center for Responsible Budget or whatever, I can't remember. It's in The Hill. And I put it up on my blog this week. In which he argues that this money, the numbers that they're talking about, are very sort of ephemeral.
Yes.
Because they don't include certain things. It doesn't, you know, it's sort of a gross number and it doesn't reflect the net. And there's a lot of stuff that, and I had heard this before. There was some talk about this before, about Greenstein had said, look, it's not really 3.5 trillion, but all these priorities that people have, the child care, the elder care, all this stuff, they're well within bounds of a much lower number to achieve what they want to achieve. In other words, this big number was kind of a weird choice on the Democrats' part to talk about in the first place. But what it did open up was the room to give the two divas, Sinema and Manchin, the ability to say, well, we lowered that number. We did our job. We got her done. And, you know, we didn't let those hippies run wild. You know, don't worry. We're in charge here. And that was sort of built into this big number, that they could bring it down and still preserve their priorities. Now, I had thought that seemed very optimistic to me. I was thinking, well, maybe they're clever enough to have done this thing. I'm doubting it now, because this is going on so long.
They see that it's total chaos. I mean, if it was the case that this was the plan, there doesn't seem to have been any plan to execute that plan. Or
right. It was just a good idea, you know. But
I mean, at this point now, we're basically hoping, and just to be clear to people, right? We're talking about $3.5 trillion over the course of 10 years. And presumably, that doesn't mean $350 billion a year. Right? For 10 years, because it may take 2 years to ramp up this program. It may take 1 year to ramp up this program. You may need to put more money up front if you're talking about construction and then operating costs or something like that. I mean, I'm just, you know, broad strokes here. But the bottom line is that you could also just say it's a 10-year plan, but we spend all the money in 5 years and we need more money after that if it's going to continue, and that gets you to 2024. You have the cost of the bill because you're just funding it for a shorter period of time, and you're basically saying to Congress, like we do with just about everything, you're going to have to vote on this or vote against it. And you know, on some level, if the Democrats were smart about this, seems to me that they would just create a staggering sunsetting of all of these different programs and just say, like, you know, in the run up to the 2024 election in April, you guys are going to have to vote against extending the tax credit for parents. In May, you're going to have to vote against the free community college. In June, against paid parental leave. I mean, on and on like this. I mean, hopefully they get there, but it's very hard to look at this leadership now and feel like they are on top of this, right? Like it's very hard to look at this and just assume and get the sense that the Democrats seem to be sort of in charge of it all. Like, why hasn't Joe Biden been out there talking about what's in this program?
He's doing it now. He was out there yesterday, and I think he was out there the day before talking about it. But I agree with you that it's been delayed. I mean, I hear Democrats, like, you know, there's some really smart ones. You know, you hear AOC or Katie Porter or somebody like that. They go on TV and they talk about what's in the program. They're going, you know, and Bernie Sanders, you know, he says, look, what do you want to cut? You want to cut Medicare benefits? You want to cut the community college? You know, I mean, he lays it out there like that. What is it that you're against anyway? You know, I mean, he's not afraid to say it. And he went after Manchin and Sinema this week, too. Yeah. You know, and I mean, he obviously was intensely frustrated. So which is kind of a clue, actually, now that I think about it, that this was not a planned thing, that all of this was just chaos. And he reached sort of the end of his rope there, at least briefly. And he's been very, very good in terms of trying to, I mean, come on, this is Bernie Sanders. And he, you know, has been in the past kind of a gadfly in many ways on some of this stuff, you know, sort of being way out there. He has been totally Mr. Responsible in terms of trying to usher this legislation over the line. and has been very much the elder statesman doing that. And I think he just kind of, you know, it got frustrated with it this week, and for good reason. It's because that if this is the plan, it hasn't materialized. It's, as you say, it seems like that may have been a thought, but there's no execution. And in meanwhile, Manchin's running around talking about strategic pauses. Kyrsten Sinema's escaping into bathrooms and refusing to talk to anybody. And we're in this stalemate, and we still are. So, you know, I wish I felt more optimistic. And honestly, I've been a little bit of a Pollyanna up to this point, thinking it's impossible to believe they won't do it, because if they don't, the failure is so extreme. Everything is lost. I can't even believe Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema would think that is a good outcome. But I'm beginning to think maybe they do, and that others who are quieter in the background are also kind of rooting for this thing to fail. We certainly know there's a handful in the House, but you know, we're not quite sure of who it is in the Senate that's backing this Manchin and Sinema play, but I know there are some. So now I'm really wondering.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine that Sanders attacked Sinema and Manchin with this intent. But it does also occur to me that if I'm Manchin and I'm Sinema, and I want to brandish, I mean, this is assuming, right? I mean, because we don't, I mean, you know, Manchin's, I think, incentive structure is fairly straightforward and obvious. He is a corporate crook. Who also wants to maintain the notion of being, independent from his party and not one of these lefties, and a guy who will take a AR-15 or whatever it is, or a shotgun, and shoot the cap and trade bill. I mean, this is the guy who he is. Kyrsten Sinema is a little bit harder to figure out, of course, Kyrsten Sinema, because she can look at Mark Kelly, who is the other senator from Arizona, and Democrat, doing much better in the polls, doing great in terms of fundraising. Like, no reason why she couldn't have been that guy. In fact, she would have been a better version of Mark Kelly, frankly, if she, you know, if she wanted to, but for whatever reason. But I guess to the extent that they want to make it clear they are bucking the party, to have Bernie Sanders go out there and denigrate them or attack them or whatever it is, you know, in this era of both like social media and hyper polarization, people define themselves by their enemies. Yep. and by their critics. And for Joe Manchin to go out there and go like, I know I've made Bernie Sanders mad. I still have respect for him, but I know, I mean, this is what I imagine he's going to say when he signs off on this bill, if he does. I know Bernie Sanders is not happy. There's a couple of things that we're both unhappy about. He may be a little bit more unhappy than me, but that's okay. And that's what he needs, right? Like, Joe Biden, for whatever reason, feels he can't do this. So here's Bernie Sanders filling this role. I don't know if it works on Kyrsten Sinema. I guess we will see. I mean, but it is just, it's hard to imagine that this was, you know, the plan. We're gonna pretend like we're gonna wrap this up by early September, and then we'll end up maybe dragging it through into December. We'll see. All right, but I want to we're not gonna resolve this today, sadly. But the point you did make in terms of like this is it, right? Like this is catastrophic. And the point that you started when you said that Manchin had said the only thread we have in America to keep democracy alive and well is the filibuster. There was a piece today by featuring this guy David Shore, whose data is like the hottest new trend in Democratic. But there's some stuff in there that is really distinct from the data, which is pretty straightforward. And we can see it even today. 40 million more Americans voted for the Democrats who are in the Senate than the Republicans. So understand what that means. You're talking about, what is that, 60 to 40%? I mean, off the top of my head, maybe more of the votes cast for Senate by Americans in this country went for Democrats. Now, granted, that's not the system that we have when it comes to the Senate, but people should understand that dynamic means it is necessarily undemocratic. And when you start to impose that dynamic on congressional seats, like we have in many states around the country, in this latest redistricting, and we had in 2010, and you see it in like states like Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, Democrats can get 63% of the vote, or excuse me, 53% of the vote, all that are cast for state legislators, and lose 65 to 35 in their representation. That's a real problem long term, particularly if you are someone who wants health care and abortion rights and unemployment and paid family leave and on and on and on and on. College. I mean, this is a real problem because Democrats could very well be a decade or more away from being able to sort of take back any type of levers of government unless they win by, you know, 80 to 20%, which is unheard of. I mean, you just need to have that many more Democratic votes because of the nature of the Senate and these redistricting. And so this is it. I mean, this could be it for a long time. And you need to use this bill as leverage from a political standpoint, too. Like, force them to end this stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I mean, it's so stunning that we've, you know, we're sort of only realizing just how undemocratic our fundamental system is. I mean, we're trying to, quote, save our democracy and blah, 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 with the Republicans cheating everywhere and doing all this stuff. But really, the fundamental structure of it is undemocratic. The Senate is an undemocratic institution. It was designed that way. And it works on a certain level if you don't have this kind of partisan polarization that we have. But when you have this, and it's, you know, it's usually in the past, you could have that, you know, 60-40 split. But some of the Republicans in conservative states would be, you know, kind of, they would be reasonable. Or you'd have Northeastern Republicans. So there used to be Republicans from California, and Republican presidents came out of California. So, you know, you could have this situation where the states would, you know, you'd have some ticket splitting and things like that. But that just isn't happening now. It is a real threat that this is coming down the pike here, that we are going to be locked out of majorities for a very long time. And you're absolutely right. What Democrats have to do, and what Republicans have done very well, I mean, I would argue that Mitch McConnell's greatest talent is being in the opposition. He's much better at it than he is in the majority. He's lucky in that the majority, the Republicans, really have no agenda anymore other than pulling back regulations, confirming judges and tax cuts. That's all they do. And that's easy enough to do. You can do both those things, by the way, in reconciliation. So, hey, how nice for them. So they can do all that stuff, do anything that they want to do if they're in the majority. But in the minority, Mitch McConnell, that is where he shines. He knows how to thwart the Democrats' agenda. And I would suggest that Democrats need to start thinking about how they can do this too, how they can use their agenda, the things that people like. If they manage to pass this big Build Back Better thing, and they do the infrastructure and they do maybe voting rights or some of the other big items on their agenda, then they are forcing the Republicans, if they do win in 2022, God forbid, but it really looks more than possible, that they are going to be forcing them to defend taking those things away from the American people. I really think it's the only chance they have. They're going to have to put out, make some big changes and big reforms and big progress, and then accept the fact that they may have to be in a position of forcing the Republicans to try and repeal those things. We saw what happened with Obamacare.
Yep.
You know, the John McCain thing. So we know that that's possible to do. You can frustrate Mitch McConnell just like Mitch McConnell can frustrate Chuck Schumer. You just have to play your cards right.
Let's just turn to and of course, you know, I guess lastly, just the cinema stuff. I am increasingly of the opinion that this is an unabashed good. You know, like I think on one hand, you look at how sort of, I don't know, weirdly personal these senators seem to take their jobs, like in the sense that there's a disconnect between 10 million people are going to get health insurance, let's say, or I don't like that person, so I'm going to vote a different way. Like, it just seems like there's some type of, and I think the more difficult it is for Sinema and Manchin in their daily lives to sort of just go about their daily lives without feeling the angst that they're creating in the American, you know, in the American public, or certainly certain sectors of it, I think it's helpful. I think that just at one point that they, because it may be a situation where they say, like, I've just, whatever, fine, let's just do this. Like, this is run out. I mean, because this is, look, this is preening. This, they're not, there's no negotiations that seem to be going on here. It's just complete preening. And it is just about wanting to get a certain amount of attention and brand awareness or whatever it is. And that is, you know, fundamentally a pretty narrow impulse, you know, and it's generated by like sort of like a narrow set of interests. It's this person's feeling like, I like to be the center of the attention and I'm going to stay here. Because if they wanted something, they both could have gotten much of what they wanted by now. I think it's quite evident, right? I mean, if they had come in and said, here's the deal, this is, I want this, this, and this, and I don't want that, that, and that, we'd be darn close to wrapping this thing up. And it doesn't appear that they've done any of that, particularly Sinema. And so if it really is just about, like, I like to be in the limelight and I'm like, I want to be the it person for the day, make them understand there's a cost associated with that. That means that, like, can't go out and, you know, eat at your favorite restaurant without, like, it being, you know, am I going to have some immigrant whose grandmother died and they couldn't visit her? Am I going to have to hear that story at dinner? You know, like, yeah, I think maybe you do need to hear that story. You know, someone whose prescription drugs are too expensive, they can't take it. Maybe you do need to hear that story at dinner. Or in the movie theater, or on your airplane, or wherever it is. I mean, I think that, you know, that's my feeling with that. And so we'll see about Kristen Sinema. But boy, the right was really, they really came in, swooped in, really, really concerned about her not hearing a speech from an immigrant in a bathroom. That's tough.
And the press did too. The press was very upset about it as well. It was really a terrible, terrible thing. Of course, these are the same people. You know, they chased Mitt Romney through the airport, called him a traitor on the airplane. They chased Lindsey Graham through the airport, had to get security. They chased Anthony Gonzalez out of the party and out of politics by making his family and him feel so insecure that they had to have police escorts going through airports. So, you know, I'm not really, really feeling the, you know, the concern on the part of these Republicans and the press over that. I mean, it seems,
without a doubt.
I mean, you know, they're going after school board members. I mean, they're threatening healthcare workers. They're threatening teachers and, you know, I mean, this is ridiculous. Election workers, think about those poor people. I mean, they're getting harassed at their homes. This is ridiculous. I mean, these nice little, you know, young people who were just sitting there saying, looking at their phone again, we helped you get elected and we really wanted you to do something like this. Yeah, that's very threatening. Poor Kirsten. Poor Kirsten.
Let's talk about this Senate report. It didn't get a lot of attention, but there was a pretty blockbuster, it seems to me, report that there was a guy in the Department of Justice who had basically gone around his superiors, connected with Donald Trump, was promised by Donald Trump to be the acting attorney general of the United States, the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, if he plays up the idea that Georgia was stolen. And, you know, I guess some people tell us the details of this, but I guess some people could say, like, well, the system worked, but, you know, I don't know. That sort of feels like, well, you know, you're pretty close. Like, I don't think I would be, you know.
Well, you could finish the sentence. The system worked in an attempted coup.
Yes. I mean, if I drive off a cliff and, you know, in my car and I just happen to be okay, like I walk away from that accident, I don't walk away going like, I don't have to worry in the future. I can do that again because it worked. The system worked. I didn't die. The system worked. Walk us through this because it's pretty, I think this is a bigger deal than the attention it's getting.
I do too. I mean, I'm actually shocked. I wrote about it for Salon this morning. What basically happened was this. I mean, first of all, Trump was running several coup plots at the same time, right? He had Giuliani and Sidney Powell out in the states doing lawsuits that they were hoping to get the Supreme Court to overturn the election. They had, you know, he had, this guy Eastman, John Eastman, drawing up plans for Mike Pence to, you know, not count electoral votes and then throw it into the House so that they could, you know, so that Donald Trump could win. Now, this one, some of it's been reported in the past. We knew that Rosen, who was the acting attorney general after Bill Barr left, and there's a story in that, too, because, you know, it was kind of weird that Bill Barr just sort of said, hey, I'm out of here abruptly. He was the top toady for Trump and actually did help Trump by saying that the Department of Justice could investigate voter fraud as the votes were still being counted, which was unprecedented and went outside of normal Department of Justice protocol. But he ended up kind of running out, you know, deserting the sinking ship at the end of December of 2020, abruptly and kind of weirdly, just kind of left. And so he was replaced by his assistant at the time, the deputy attorney general, Jeffrey Rosen, became the acting attorney general. In any case, we knew that there had been this weird thing that happened with this guy named Jeffrey Clark, who had worked in the civil division. He wasn't in the top echelon of the Department of Justice, but somehow or another, he connected with Trump. We now know through a Pennsylvania congressman who had told Trump, you know, I've got this guy in the Department of Justice, apparently, and he's with you. You need to talk to him. Clark came and started working with Trump on a coup plot that had to do with the Department of Justice, which is, as you say, suggesting that they send a letter to the Georgia legislature saying that they had evidence of voter irregularity in the election and that they should call a special session and do what they will with the electoral votes. In other words, to, you know, overturn the election in Georgia. And it was planned. He wrote a draft letter stating all this. And it was also planned that it would go to a bunch of other states, the other states where it was close and that they were contesting the election. So through this period, after Rosen came in, Trump was on the horn with him almost daily, sometimes several times daily, trying to convince him. And this was all documented by his deputy, Donahue, who was taking notes through the whole thing, and that he was pressuring him constantly to work with Clark to do this thing. And they finally reached a point where Clark called up Rosen and said, hey, look, you know, Trump's going to replace you with me if you don't do what he says. And there were threats coming from other people, too. Apparently, there was some guy who was involved in that weird Texas lawsuit that they sent to the Supreme Court, you know, that all the attorneys general signed on to. He calls up and said, hey, calls up Rosen, the attorney general, just some lawyer. I guess Trump gave him his number, calls him up and says, you know, if you don't work with us on this, I'm going to have to tell the president that you're being recalcitrant. You know, some kind of threat. I mean, actually, you said that I'm going to have to tell the president that you're being recalcitrant. So in any case, and all this is documented, this is coming from testimony from the people who were involved. And Rosen, you know, and Donahue, they're saying, well, we're not going to do that. And if Trump replaced, you know, we're out. We're all of us are out. So they have this big meeting on January 3rd in the White House. And it's with Rosen, Donahue, Clark was there, and the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his deputy, and Trump. And they talk for hours about this thing. And when at the beginning of the meeting, when Rosen walks in, Trump says to him, well, we know that you, Rosen, you're not going to overturn the election. It's like, Wow, talk about saying the quiet part out loud there, Trump. But, you know, in any case, they had this long discussion in which it was brought up that, you know, if Clark replaces Rosen, that everybody, the entire top level of the Department of Justice will quit. And Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, said he'd quit too. He called, he and his people were going to quit. And, you know, remember at this point, there was all kinds of churning. There were people kind of getting ready to leave and all this. And so Cipollone says that, and he called it a murder-suicide pact, right? And if you do this, the whole thing's going to explode. You're going
to
be completely...
He's saying this to Trump. I mean, he's saying to Trump that this is a no-way win. This is a no-win situation for you.
Right. You will lose. This will be done. You absolutely do not want to do this. So Trump was apparent at that point. He backed off. It took hours, apparently, to get him to that point, to talk him off this ledge. These people were just sitting there telling him, look, it can't be done. So Trump finally agrees. And he says, OK, we won't do this. Now, remember, he had other coup plots in his back pocket. He was juggling other things. He still had Giuliani out there. He had Eastman getting, you know, prepping Mike Pence to overturn the election. And of course, he had January 6th coming up, which he had signaled to all his people, come to D.C. It will be wild. So, that, you know, the fact that he set aside this Department of Justice plot at the last minute, which he, by the way, had been working on for weeks and pushing. Well, this is the part that gets me. So they come out with this report, right? This is, and it's shocking and stunning. This is a president who was plotting a coup. There's no doubt about it. It is there in black and white. And he was pressuring top levels of the Justice Department to go along with it. And remember, he had had some success pressuring top, you know, he had replaced his Department of National Intelligence with a toady, John Ratcliffe. He had implanted a bunch of people in the Pentagon, more of his henchmen over there. So, you know, he thought he could do this. He thought he could replace Rosen with Clark. And it was only his own person, I think Pat Cipollone, his White House counsel, who was a very loyal Trumper, who convinced him that this was not going to work for him. So what happens then? They put out the report yesterday, and out come the Republicans with a report saying, well, we don't understand what the problem is. The president merely asked for advice from his senior advisors, and then he followed it. That is what they said. It is shocking. So apparently it's perfectly normal for presidents to plot coups. But if his advisors advise against it and he follows the advice, it's all good. So nothing to see here.
And here's the thing, is that all this stuff, whether it was the Eastman memo or all these machinations from, you know, number three at the DOJ or four or whatever Clark was.
I was way down that list.
Way down the list. I mean, the point is, Dick Cheney came up with the unitary executive theory about 30 years before he was able to implement it. Yeah. These ideas don't just go and get shelved, particularly when they get this close. These are all, in some ways, we don't know that until in retrospect, dry runs. And so, I mean, this is, you know, again, this is one of those situations where the people need to be held to account. It's going to be interesting to see if they do anything with the subpoenas. But we are out of time. We'll have a better sense, I think, by midweek next week, if they're going to do anything to hold those subpoenas as being worth.
Well,
the paper.
Remember, they put Susan McDougall, they put her on a perp walk, put her in handcuffs, and jailed her for 18 months for refusing to testify.
That's a good point. That's over Whitewater. Yeah. Heather Parton, Digby, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Have a great weekend.
All right, quick break. We'll be right back after this.
We'll be right back.
All right. Well, if you're watching us on Peacock, that is all our time today. I just wanted to say Susan McDougal did go to prison for at least 18 months. I think it was closer, maybe even to 22 months, but total time. It was because she refused to answer questions of a grand jury about Bill Clinton and apparently some questions about sexual stuff. So it wasn't necessarily avoiding a subpoena from Congress. Nevertheless, you're supposed to actually, you want a Congress that's able to subpoena people, I think, to talk. You know, people want to go there, plead the fifth, you plead the fifth. Or you just say goodbye, as I will say to those of us, those of you who are watching us on Peacock. Have a great weekend. See you on Monday. For those of you who are sticking around, ooh, do we have a surprise for you? Well, it's not really a surprise. But before we do, we need to play some music. Should we let her in and play the music? Why don't we play the music and then let her in as the music plays? Oh. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been far too long to welcome our next guest. I give you, ladies and gentlemen, Judy Gold.
Level-headed.
Fuck you!
Calm, cool, and collected.
I have a bigger penis than him.
Judy Gold is on the line to keep us all connected.
What the fuck is the matter with him?
A steady hand to guide us. She'll keep us calm and carry on.
No fucking way!
Too bad Jimmy Reefer Cuck didn't find her worthy of a song. Well, Judy Gold.
And he's such a fucking penis head liar. I'm not kidding. That's the president of the United States. That's the president. What the fuck? Like this guy, how did this happen?
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, Judy Gold. Hello, Judy.
Hello, I'm trying to get on my stupid fucking headset, but it's not working.
Well, I mean, it all seems
to
be.
But you don't need it, right? Because it's me.
Yeah, it's you. I mean, I hear you. You sound good. I don't know.
Look how handsome you look.
Well, thank you. You look great yourself.
Sort of an odd. I just got off the Peloton.
You got a Peloton?
I did. Yeah, I caved.
You caved the Peloton, and all right. Well, that's exciting. What do you do?
No, it's not. I'm so fucking fat. I'm sick of it.
Wait. So what do you do on the Peloton? Like, I'm not clear. What's the Peloton? Okay. Peloton.
So the Peloton. Wait, I'm moving my. Well, it's fine. The Peloton has, you can spin, which is a lot of spinning, and it's a lot of, oh, you can be whoever you are. You can be who you want to be. Who do you want to be today? And everyone's like perfect looking, and it's really, and I fucking hate that.
Everybody's perfect looking. So there's a video. There's video.
Oh, yeah. It's a whole big screen, and they're all telling you to climb 400,000 hills,
Who are these people? Is it live? Are they in a room?
There are some live classes, and then they're all recorded. So you can pick, people have their favorite instructors. And then I need an instructor who's going to be like, wow, you decided to get on the bike today. Great. How much weight did you gain? You're going to move your leg? Like someone like that who's going to, but it's a lot of, okay, we're going to go higher.
Are they all British?
Yeah.
Now, wait a second. So can they see you if you're doing a live instructor? Yeah. They can't see.
Well, they can see your name, and they're always like, oh, congratulations, Sam Sita, 7,000 rides. Congratulations, And happy birthday. Happy birthday, Matt. Happy birthday, 10 million rides. Bradley, here you are, your first ride. That's great. It's like, it's so fucking annoying. And then they have meditation. Then you can get it on your phone too. So you when you're walking in the woods, they can be like, okay. It's like a whole, but I had to get it because I used to go to the gym all the time. And then I don't know if you heard about the pandemic.
The pandemic.
Yeah.
I got to say, this Peloton thing seems to really agree with you. I feel like you're calmer. I feel like you are more centered and more balanced. And I feel like this energy that you're getting out with the Peloton, I feel like it's really...
Really?
I mean, it's a... Yeah, it's a...
Wow.
New Judy Gold, in a way.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I really am picking up on this. It's really made you, like, even keeled.
Yeah, that's the... Yeah, that would be the term to describe me. Even keeled.
So... Have you been recognized by an instructor on there? Did they go like, oh my God, Judy, good.
No, well,
favorite.
No, I feel like people, like, because you can high five people, like, during the class. You can.
How you do you high five somebody? Like
it shows up on your screen. It's like high
emoji,
five.
Like an emoji. Right. Now, can you look at the left and right and see these people, or you can't see them?
No, you can't see anyone. It's just your name. And then you have hashtags. So since my name is Judy Gold, J-E-W-D-Y, I feel like they avoid me.
I see.
You know, because they're never going to be like, oh, Judy Gold, Jew. You know, they're never going to do that. So
they're going to pretend like they're not picking up on that.
It also it says like male in their 40s. You know, it'll be, you know, that they have that information. And so... And then you can start a class with a bunch of people to be like, oh, I go by the music. So you'll be like, oh, I want a 70s disco class. And then they'll say, you can take a class with 20 other people in 5 minutes. And these are people who are going to take the same class as you. And then you can be competitive with them. And they're all like ahead of you. And you're the last one. You feel like a fat fucking piece of shit who can't breathe. It's fun.
Well, it sounds like it. Sounds a lot of fun. Sounds like you're having a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. Be in shape, baby.
So let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Speaking of keeping you in shape, have you started to go out and do comedy shows live?
Yes, I have, Samuel.
Inside.
They have to be masked.
Oh, they have to be masked. And
They have to be vaxxed.
Okay.
And then it was masked. Now they've just done vaxxed. It went from like 25% of the people, you know, capacity, masked and vaxxed. Then it went to 50% masked and everyone gets their own microphone. So there's like a bucket with used microphones and new microphones.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So you'd have to walk on stage and switch the mic out. And every time I would just walk on stage and forget, you know, because I'm doing this so long. So I'd be like, oh, fuck, can someone bring me a mic? And then now it's just you have to be vaxxed. And
audience has to be vaxxed too, right? Everybody in the place.
Everybody has to be vaxxed. Coleman actually brought his own. I used to bring my own mic, and then I didn't know they were not doing the, you know, clean mic bucket and dirty mic bucket. So I might start bringing my own mic again.
Or
smell anyway. Don't.
Yeah, no, I know. Microphones are, they should be all personalized, it seems to me.
Right.
Did you catch Jim Brewer's? He's only doing unvaxxed stuff.
Good. Have fun. What is? I just don't. This is the fight. This is the hill you're going to die on.
Isn't that marketing? Isn't that just marketing? Isn't Brewer just sitting there going like, "Oh, wait a second. I don't really care about this one way or another, but
right.
I'm going to get every single comedy person who doesn't want to get vaccinated or is pissed at vaccination. They're all just going to come and see me. It's going to be like it's not even going to be like, these aren't going to be fans. These are going to be activists.
Right. And if that's who you want in your audience, great. Have fun with that.
Well, I think Jib does, frankly. Now let me ask you, so how has it been? Like, how was it? Like, are the audiences just sort of like, ecstatic that they're there?
Yes.
I gotta say, like, when I go out, the closest I've been into a closed environment has been like in a bar with like all the doors open in the
open.
Front.
Yeah.
Like a garage. And I'm in there and 20% of me is, you know, just a ball of anxiety. And then the other 8% is, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to watch the game or something like that.
Okay, but isn't that normal without a pandemic?
There's 25% to 35% of me that's anxious. But right. Then you get the extra 20%. So it's really
okay. So you're 40, 45. Yeah. Okay.
55% anxiety. But I get an extra 20% of anxiety, 25% yeah. of anxiety.
I definitely feel it. I mean, the ones in New York are very strict. But I do feel it like, you know how you used to like selling merch or something like that. That I can't deal with. That's what hang around. Freaks me the fuck out. Yeah. And like shaking my hand and can I have a hug and can I take a selfie? You know, it's fine. And then you take a selfie with someone and they're like, can you take your mask off? And then if you do that, then everyone on the internet's like, oh, I thought you were a vaxxer and you're taking your mask off. It's like, shut the fuck up. But they're pretty strict. They're pretty strict. But I have to go to Florida in November. I'm really worried about that.
Well, I mean, the upside is that everything seems to be going down right now. There is some notion that people have had that there's tends to be like 2 month cycles for a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't know. We don't know yet.
You know what? What I do know that it could have been over if these fucking assholes would have worn their fucking masks and gotten vaxxed. But no. We have to have a bunch of dumb fucking idiots. And then I have to read articles, you know, how to talk to an anti-vaxxer, what to say. Here's what you say to an anti-vaxxer. Fuck you, you selfish piece of shit. I hope you get COVID. Bye now, fucking asshole. That's what you're supposed to say.
Are you sure that's supposed to say?
Yes, I read all the articles. Go fuck yourself. I hope you get COVID and D-I-E, okay? Because you're an asshole. You know, it's like not about them. It's about other people.
I would agree. And I mean, I don't know. For me, my anger is really geared towards people who are espousing the anti-vax stuff. I mean,
right.
I think there's a lot of people out there. There's a decent amount of people out there who I think are just don't understand how important it is, and it might be too difficult for them to do it. I mean, certainly the vaccine mandates helped because it forced the companies to give people time off at least.
Right. I mean, I get the autoimmune people. Yes, I totally understand that. But you know what? You're already vaxxed, asshole, and your dog is vaxxed. So what the fuck is wrong with you?
There is I think part of it is you got people out there who are just like who are promoting it, who are, you know,
right.
In where people trust them and they're promoting it. And it seems pretty messed up. And then there's other people who just sort of feel like the real story here is how we're suppressing the truth about some drug, name it, that might mitigate the impact of COVID. That's the real story. That's not actually the real story.
Right.
The story is people are telling other people not to get vaccinated.
Right. So
what is
harassing people and harassing, you know, parents bringing their kids to school. Like, if you don't want to get vaccinated and you want to die from COVID, be my guest. Have fun, enjoy, go fuck yourself. But leave people alone. Leave people alone.
There is, it is sort of stunning when you think about how much more harassment we've seen.
Right.
From people who don't want other people to wear masks.
Right.
People who are telling other people to wear masks. Now, I get it. Maybe you're walking down the street and somebody gives you a look at one point during this, like, but that's, you know, I think we're adults here. We can all handle
it. Okay. Here's the worst part.
Look at somebody.
The worst part, see, the place I'm the most fearful is in airports, not on the plane, but in the airports. And I am going to get killed because, first of all, the ones who wear the chin diaper and don't cover their nose, the passive aggressive fucks, those are the worst. So I now have resorted to anytime I walk past someone, I'm like, nose! If they're not wearing a mask, I'm like, mask! And I think I'm going to get killed, but I don't care. I mean, I do care. I don't really want to get killed. But you know what I mean? It's just, you know, it's supposed to be over your nose. And I was on a flight where they had to escort a family off.
Really?
Yep. The parents wouldn't wear it and they wouldn't make the kids wear it.
Well, what do they think? They go on the plane and they think like, well, they'll right. let me be the ones who aren't, you know, it's much harder for the four of us, coincidentally, than everybody else on the plane.
Right, right.
Judy.
Yes.
What would it take?
Yes.
For you to get someone to walk behind you in an airport, videotaping you yelling at people, nose, mask.
I do hospital. It anytime.
But I need somebody to videotape you doing it. I don't want.
Okay. I'm a comedian. I don't travel with anyone. I'm going to my niece's wedding. I could maybe get, you know, someone to
Where
do
is
it.
Is that? Is that going to be outdoor?
Yes, Arizona.
All right. There you go. What else is new? Like, so as you, it feels like your life has sort of changed pretty significantly from, I mean, I don't think, you know, people understood, like, people in bands and comedians, yeah. they were completely shut down. Small subset of people, everybody else is shut down, but you've been doing stand up like X number of nights a week for 30, 40 years.
Right. It's awful, but I did do a lot of outdoor and Zoom, but yeah, it's like your life completely stops. But I did learn I don't need to go out every single night and do sets. But I did have my book come out in the middle of the pandemic, so that was all virtual. So that sucked.
Yep.
But I was busy. I kept myself busy, but I've always done that. But yeah, hearing that audience live for the first time in May, oh my God, it was unbelievable. And by the way, Samuel, a lot of people are like, why haven't you been on the Majority Report? And I'm like, ask Sam, because I don't know. Apparently, you know, because you are one of the two shows where people stop me and are like, I heard they actually come to my shows because of this show.
What is the other show?
Sandra Bernhardt on Sirius XM.
Oh, all right. Fair
yeah,
enough.
Those are the two shows where I'm like, I listen to you, or when are you going to be on, and blah, 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 blah.
I didn't realize she yes. had a show on there. I did one of her like talk shows way, way back in the day.
Right.
She had one of those type of things.
Yeah.
She was still... Well, I'm glad part of the reason why you do that is to like you sending a message, you know, like that's what you do. You hold back.
You have turned into such a Jew. You know, you send a message. What is going on with you? Your hair looks fucking amazing.
Well, thank you. The hair's grown long. Yeah. That gives me a lot of confidence to get a little more Jewy.
Right. Yeah. You're definitely Jewing it up.
Yeah, I'm totally doing it up.
Yeah.
So, is it going to be the same? Like when you go into these rooms now, is it the same?
You know what? Here's the difference, Sam. I have now realized that, you know, my act is pretty much dedicated to telling people to stop fucking taking themselves so seriously. And it's okay to laugh. And you know, everything is not about you. No comic was thinking about your childhood trauma when they wrote this bit. Okay. It's not about you. And the thing I've noticed, they are ready to laugh. They really want to laugh because they felt like, you know, that they were without laughter for so long. Oh, shut up, phone. Shut the fuck up. It's my Mary Tyler Moore theme phone. Okay. And I noticed that you'll say a joke, you'll do a joke that could be deemed controversial, and they will laugh. And then catch themselves like, oh, right, I'm not supposed to laugh at that. And that is the saddest part of going back to the clubs. It's like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, are we going to really do this? Satire, humor. I don't want to live in a world without laughter because you're triggered by a word. Okay. Listen to the fucking thought. Listen to the intent of the comic. You know, it's just, that's the part. That's what I've, and there's also been a split in the comedy community, which there never was, with this vax. And, you know, it's true with the mask and vax and orange fuckface.
Interesting. That is interesting.
You remember when it was all, we were all like, always had each other's backs.
I mean, I, you know, was never deep in the the stand-up world, and I will say that, like, in Boston, we would work, like, you know, I worked primarily like a Catch, a Rising Star, and then I would do some outside rooms, but not that much. And there was like a little bit of a cleave that I think is similar to the one that exists now, where it's just like there was I think we would have been called, you know, like our crew, like, you know, Cross and
and
people coming out of like a Catch to some extent. And there was like other, like, you know, sort of more, I don't know, people maybe who were, well, I don't know if they were necessarily more local Boston, but they were just, I just sort of feel like the way I would express it is that they would call, I got the feeling they would call us fags because we would talk about.
Right. But, you know, Boston was ruled by like Lenny Clark, you know?
Yes.
That was the brand of comedy. And then there were you guys and Paula Poundstone and all these people who were like really a different genre.
Yeah, but isn't that very similar to the line now? I mean, isn't that like when we talk about that cleave? I mean, isn't there a lot of that? Like, right? Like,
there was respect. There was, I don't know. I mean, I did go to Boston a lot to perform because it was a great place to, you know,
yes,
deal with shit audiences who were like not gonna, you know, it was hard. It was harder. It was rowdier. You definitely learned something from Boston audiences, but I don't know. I always felt like there was some sort of respect, but I don't know because I wasn't in your little.
I mean, I just sensed that like if I went to Nick's Comedy Stop, there was a little bit of hostility. And,
I went there on purpose to, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, you wanted to get people's face and you wanted to also, like, you know, that I think
hone my craft,
feeds you, it feels like a little bit. But it is interesting that there's this split in the comedy world, both in terms of like that vax and stuff. And I think the language stuff, like, I mean, broadly speaking, I tend to believe that intent is hugely important.
Right.
I also, you know, I never found comedy so sacrosanct that I cared that much about it. I do remember I said that as a kid, we had a Hebrew school confirmation class talent show, and I must have been probably like 13 or 14. I had seen Rodney Dangerfield at the Chateau de Ville in Newton. My buddy Charlie's brother took us there. And so I had memorized all these Rodney Dangerfield things, and I'm out there, and it's just like the parents and the rabbis. And I say, I send my kid to college. He's majoring in fucking off. And I hear that same thing. And everybody just sucks in as they realize, like, the rabbis are there.
Right.
And he just said, fuck off in the.
Right.
Yeah, and the rabbi and I never got past that.
Oh, because the rabbi never says fuck off either, you know?
We actually got into a big fight when I think it was like a confirmation trip to Israel, and it had to do with Lebanon. It ended up getting, I got very estranged from that rabbi.
All right, where is he now?
I think he was hugely successful after that.
No way!
Yes, he went on to probably get to a much bigger congregation.
All right, then.
Yep.
And look at you. You're on the television and the radio.
Right, right. Where is he now?
What the hell is he doing? Fasting? Is he fasting?
Probably.
He's never had a lobster roll.
No, that's probably also true. He's missing
a cheeseburger.
Oh, so what else is happening? So you must be like energized by the comedy, and then what? Is that it?
So I got a writing job. I wrote on season 5, which is unfortunately the final season of Better Things, which is on FX, which stars Pamela Adlon.
Ah.
And I play a character. I played a character last season. I played the same character this season. And I also was in the writer's room. So that was great. That was like a gift from God. And so I don't know what
you're out in LA or you're just in the writer's
room. No, it was Zoom. I was just in LA, but yeah, it was Zoom. And
which is interesting because I still haven't met the writers in person. And I really, I've tried to explain to them how gigantic I am. And I don't think that they realize that I'm gigantic because we really just saw each other's head. But it was great. That was great. And I don't know what's going on, but I am getting cast in all these dramatic roles lately.
Like what?
And I'm not allowed to talk about one that I'm doing, but there's one I did. I got cast in The First Lady on Showtime.
Whoa.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm in the Eleanor Roosevelt block. Eleanor Roosevelt is played by Gillian Anderson.
I've heard of her. She's out there, right?
Yeah. Lovely person. And then I just did Better Things. I just shot Better Things. And then I'm doing something else. Now I'm like, what the fuck is going on? I mean, I'm not complaining, even though I could. But yeah.
Why would you complain?
No, I'm just saying, because that's all I fucking do, Sam.
Do you find being in a writer's room via Zoom better than being in a writer's room not via Zoom?
The Zoom versus lot, like you can't read.
You can't read other people's
right, body language. But I could send messages to one writer about another writer. So I was always like,
careful.
Can you believe what the fuck?
And so in the room, the way that happens is you're just going like a quick glance. If Matt's over there and he's reading his storyline, you're just looking over like more of this shit and
right.
You can't say it, but now you can actually articulate the whole thing.
Well, now you can, you know, we were talking all over each other, like The View. So then Pamela sent us all flags. So then we had to raise a flag. That didn't work. like a real flag. But I mean, we figured it out. But the good thing about Zoom room was that it'd be like, all right, you guys ready for lunch? And then, you know, come back in 45 minutes and I'd go ride the Peloton. You know, like I wouldn't do that if I was
right.
You know, so I did. You could get shit done because you weren't traveling anywhere. But it was also L.A. time. So I worked late and I'm also sitting in a fucking chair. All day.
I wish I could
staring at people.
I wish I could understand what that meant. What that was about.
God, you're funny. God, you have not lost it, Sam.
Yep. To the extent that I ever had it, yeah. I still have it intact. That's why
you really do.
Never want it too much.
Right, right.
You have more to lose. Right?
And I just want to ask. Yeah. I know that you haven't asked me about this. When the fuck is that asshole going to be arrested? When the fuck? Okay. Sorry.
I don't know that he's going to. I think that I would put probably a better chance of being president in 2024 than getting arrested.
I got to move.
Where would you go?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean,
Nova Scotia?
I can't go to Germany because I'm not... You know, a lot of people are getting their German passports because they're what? Great. They're great. Yeah, because their grandparents died in the Holocaust. They're giving out, you know.
Oh.
I mean, I always wanted to go to Berlin, but no, that's... I don't know. I'm not Irish.
You're not Irish?
No, I'm not. I it's just really upsetting, Sam.
I understand. Are you following politics as much or no? Do you find
I'm trying not to, but then I do get the paper. Here's the paper.
In general, are following politics less or more?
Less.
Yeah. Much less.
Because
right?
Yeah, but I still want to know what's going on. And I have realized he did monopolize so much of my fucking brain. But I just, it's like, I've always believed that people in karma, I have believed in karma. And now I don't believe, I just can't believe this shit.
That he's getting away with it.
Right. And that those fuckers aren't showing up for their subpoenas. Their subpoenas. I hate them. They're disgusting.
Is there any
and
way
that to, insurrection that that
with, the Peloton? Like you can maybe like, I sort of feel like if you had the ability to, you know, ride your bike and run over some of these people, you might.
Oh my God. Wouldn't that be great? Or if they had a boxing class and it was those fucking assholes. Oh my God. I would love that.
You can do boxing on your Peloton.
No, I'm just saying if they did.
All right.
I'm sure they have a boxing class. They have so many classes, Sam.
But how do you box on your bicycle?
You know, they have classes off the bicycle. They have like floor shit. You get it. You put it on your, you know, computer or your iPad or something.
Yeah.
Or the new one has a movable screen.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
I will think about it. Probably not.
Okay. Well, you look great.
Well, you look great too. It has been great catching up with you. I'm so glad all these things. I can't wait to see you on some show.
I know. I can't believe it. I'm going to be, you'll be like, wow, she really can act.
I don't have, I knew this. I've known this for 20 years ago, 22 years ago, I cast you. Your acting was
that's right.
Exquisite in that.
Do you think it was more than 20 years ago? Because I don't think I had a child then.
It was more than 20 years ago.
Oh my God, we're so fucking old.
I know it.
Do you wake up sometimes and you're like, oh my God, I have maybe 30 good years left?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that I wake up sometimes. I would say twice a night.
And I'm pushing it with 30. I'm pushing it with 30.
2 and 4 a.m. And then the other is whenever I get up, which is, you know, 3 hours later.
Right. So. And then what I do is I go, okay, I have 25 good years. And then I go back 25 and I remember everything because it wasn't that fucking long ago. And then you're like, oh my God, I'm dead. I'm almost dead.
30. Yeah. I mean, 30 is just not, I mean, 30. 30 really solid good years. I'm looking for another 50 that I've made some commitments. But I imagine really 30. But you know, I know people who they're in their early 90s and you'd think they were 70.
I know, but they're still
not going to be that person. I'm not going
to. Right. I mean, they seem like there's still leakage and shit going on that I don't want to deal with.
Oh yeah. Tell me about it.
Yeah.
Well, Judy, we will update this as we get closer and closer to the end of that.
Yes. Now listen, Sam, I got to plug a date because, I'm going to be in Scarsdale where there's a lot of Jews.
Right.
October 23rd at some new club called Jackie B's, and I want to plug that date.
Jackie B's? Are you still doing the podcast or no?
Yes! That's nice.
I don't
that
know.
That is so
I
nice. You still doing that radio thing you do with the reporting?
People ask me that while I'm interviewing them.
Wait, I'm looking at my other dates.
I've had ask me if I'm still doing the Majority Report as I'm interviewing them. Like literally.
All right. Who asked you that?
Steve McKenzie.
Oh, he's a fucking asshole.
He's
where am I going to be? And I'm going to be in Florida at the Misner Park Cultural Center, November 6th.
People can go to judygold.com.
Yes, they can.
Florida.
I can't believe. Can you believe that fucking DeSantis? So that's it. I'm going to be traveling and showing up on your television set.
Folks, go out and see Judy.
Sam, I miss you. Can we not? I need you not to wait as this long
anymore. I don't know what happened. I had to be honest with you. I really don't. I lose track of time.
Right. Well, just remember, 30.
Judy, I love you. Thank you so much.
I love you. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the free portion of our program today. Hate to be abrupt, but just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. If you want to help this show survive and thrive, become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get the fun half, which we do almost every single day of the year. That is a weekday, almost. So there you go. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, Majority Discord. Come on, the Discord. We got 4,000 people there. Check out the AM Quickie. Go to majority.fm, scroll down, sign up. You get the AM Quickie every morning in your email inbox. And also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Yeah, on Sunday, David Griscom and I will be recording the October Think Tank for Left Reckoning, patreon.com/leftreckoning. I'm going to be talking to, there's a question I think asking me about how I read books. I'm going to be giving a little bit of a tutorial on that, how to say, rip the DRM off of a ebook and make it into an audiobook, things like that, little pro tips, so help you... can read a University Press book while you're washing the dishes. Patreon.com/leftreckoning for that.
And you just see that DRM floating out into the ocean.
Exactly. Freedom.
Folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on.
Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on.
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.